Welcome, Action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time, as we reach the penultimate edition of our 90s Kurt Russell season. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, we are talking Breakdown. And who do I mean by we? Well, of course, I mean my returning regular co-host. He's a screenwriter, he's one-third of the Bloodhound Picks podcast, and a man who ain't no donut king. It's Mr. Craig Draheim.
Hey, I don't even know you, buddy.
You did think of one in here.
Yeah, last minute.
You were worried you were not going to have a response quote, but yeah. I'm just glad you didn't call me shit for brains. I thought you might go for it. Like.
Yeah.
But anyway. Craig isn't the only co-host on this one. No. We are also joined by a special guest in the form of a former guest on the podcast before. He's the Ghost Waits director, Mr. Adam Stovall.
What would you do with 90,000 donuts?
Everybody's I don't know we'll discuss further how that competition came to be, like what's that all about, you know, like I don't 90,000 donut, Jesus Christ. I mean, like, that's like your whole house. It, like, we'll discuss it further. I need to give background details on the film.
The question of shelf life truly looms over this.
it really does. I mean, you just have to become a donut shop, I think. Like,
right. But like for a weekend, yeah. Like a pop-up donut shop.
Yeah, exactly.
And only for cheap, like, gas station donuts, not right. Like,
yeah. Oh man, I came in here hoping for a moon pie.
Yeah.
No moon pies, just donuts.
Yeah.
That's the name of it. No moon pies, just donuts.
Yep, that's it. I don't even know what a moon pie is. They're not sold over here. I don't know.
They're like they're barely sold in the Midwest anymore. They're kind of more considered like a southern treat. But it's just like a cookie with, not even a cookie, it's a
kind of cakey,
yeah, with marshmallow in the middle and it's coated in chocolate.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Fair enough. Yeah. Cool. Okay.
I mean, there's a reason we all have diabetes.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I mean, I'm recording from Scotland, the home of the deep fried Mars bar. So, like, I really can't be smug on this one, like, as much as I want to be.
I was going to say, I've eaten in Glasgow. No. There's no high horse there.
There is. I've got no legs to stand on this. I'm not going to pretend that Scotland is a healthy eating nation. But at this part of the podcast, I usually give the background details of the film, so I will do that now. Breakdown was released on May the 2nd, 1997. It was directed by Jonathan Mostow, whose other notable credits include the likes of U-571 and Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines, and was written by Mostow and also Sam Montgomery, who also was a writer on U-571 and doesn't have a lot of other film credits, but it did write a few episodes of 24 and a crime drama called Unforgettable, which I've never heard of. Review wise, it is currently sitting at a 6.9 out of 10 on IMDb, keeping our ratings quite high for this season, doing well. 81% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 52 reviews, 73 on Metacritic based on 19 reviews, and it has a 3.5 on Letterboxd. Box office wise, it made $50.1 million off a $36 million budget, making it the 51st biggest film of 1997. Kind of weirdly sandwiched in between Mortal Kombat Annihilation at 50 and Absolute Power at 52. It's a weird triple bill if you want to do that.
Really peaks in the middle.
My memory of Absolute Powers is it's like, okay, it's not prime Clint by any means, but it's kind of fine. But like, yeah, definitely the best of the, we're definitely reviewing the best of the three. If you're really hoping for a Mortal Kombat Annihilation episode, you will be waiting for a while, I'm going to say.
Yeah. Just keep on hoping.
I have no intention of rewatching that film anytime soon. But back to this film, Breakdown. So, well, you know, since you're the special guest, Adam, we'll cut to you first. What's your relationship with this movie?
I mean, I saw it when it came out in 97. I graduated high school that year. I remember, so like, J.T. Walsh is in it, and he died not long after this movie came out. Yeah. And I remember it being this, like, kind of a big deal for a minute because he was kind of one of our great American character actors. And this, you know, he, I don't know that Breakdown really like asks him to do anything he hadn't done before, but it is kind of a great representation of how he like, how he could just live in a character. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. he wasn't afraid of the messiness and, you know, like the, we'll get into it, but like the, towards the end, you get to see a bit more of his life. He, you know, it widens a little bit. And I just found it fascinating that in the very short amount of screen time that it has, you really get a sense of the like dynamic that he kind of carries in his like friendships and his family life. And yeah, he was amazing. I actually think this movie, like texturally, is just fantastic. I love how it looks. And, you know, there's the light when he goes into Belle's diner, the like shards of light through the blinds. And then there's one shot of Kurt Russell walking in the desert over a railroad track. And it's just gorgeous. You know, I did find myself kind of watching it this morning thinking like, man, movies just used to look different. Yeah. Like, I just saw Black Widow yesterday and like we walked out and I was like, that was a perfectly fine movie. There was no inventive staging. There was no really, they didn't really do anything with the narrative, but like if what you want is a movie, it is here for you. And I miss when this used to be that. Like, mm-hmm. Breakdown is just a very well-made movie. You know, I got to know John Mostow a little bit, you know, years back when I was living in L.A., and it was, like, the first thing I said was, like, man, Breakdown was dope. Yeah, I like it. And Kurt Russell's just the man. I mean, we're going to get into that because obviously it's Kurt Russell season. And I have not been able to get on for any of their episodes, so I'm going to talk a lot about my feelings about Kurt Russell. But yeah, to this movie specifically, I just, you know, it doesn't do anything wrong. It's, you know, I mean, it's not pushing the form forward, but like, it's just such a pleasant, like, viewing experience. Mm-hmm. I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. We will obviously get into it further, but you know, like, yes, it's not an inventive film, and you know, it's kind of made in the kind of classic B movie mold, but it is absolutely top class at that thing. It, like, that's, you know, it like, yeah, at the thing that it's going for, it's absolutely top level.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. It is totally a B movie, but the execution of it, and the way that Mostow directed it, like, you can see why he got, you know, really, really big assignments right after this, because he does totally raise it to another level.
Okay, so we'll cut to you now, Craig. What is your relationship with this movie?
Mine is that there's kind of like a couple others on the season where I know that I've seen it, but it almost played as like a first watch because I couldn't really remember anything except probably the ending, which, you know, obviously we'll get into the spoilers of what happens at the very end. But yeah, and I was very pleasantly surprised. You know, this is a season that I went in thinking, because we do the awards at the end of the whole season. I was like, okay, so it's going to be Tombstone is basically going to take the cake. Just like how last season it was Copland or whatever it may be. But yeah, this, I was like, oh no, this is the runner. It might be the one that takes it for me, because not as Adam was saying, it's just great. And I agree actually with this versus something like Black Widow or whatever it may be, where it was just, there was a period where movies, you could really see, even if it was trying to be something else or if it was paying homage or whatever it may be, it was still clearly that director's, there was still like a stamp of the director or the creator or whoever it may be, where now it's just like this series of it all kind of feels like the director could be thrown out with some of the bigger movies because they all feel like the same person could have made them and things like that. And so this was nice in that sense.
I would push back on that a little bit. like, even within some of the massive franchises, I think there is certain directors who have still put their stamp on things. Like, if you, like, you know, we're talking about the MCU. So, like, you know, things like Guardians of the Galaxy or Thor Ragnarok, or, you know, it's, you know, you can definitely tell that, you know, Ragnarok's a Taika Waititi film, and you can definitely tell that the James Gunn's all over Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, like, so that, you know, the director imprint can still be there. I mean, I kind of get what you're talking about. You know, it's all part of the big Disney machine and all that kind of thing. But, you know, there is equally, you know, there's still good blockbusters being made.
One that might even be like a more direct thing to this, like, because I was thinking about Black Panther, and, you know, Black Widow again is a fine movie, but like, there's a car chase where there's just like 17 different angles on the car without cutting away, like, and it makes you appreciate Ryan Coogler. I mean, I always appreciate Ryan Coogler. He is amazing. But like the simplicity of his filmmaking in Black Panther, and how it's just like, no, we're just going to settle down and watch this. You know, we're not going to cut between a million different things. You're going to be able to see the choreography, you know, see the geography of these things. And Breakdown is similarly, like, it's, I don't know that I really appreciated it before I made a movie, but like, you know, the cleanliness of just like, no, set up your camera, show what you're showing, and don't try to hide and cheat a bunch of stuff in a million cuts that just serve to dissociate the audience from the action.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, I do feel like that's becoming back in vogue. I feel like, you know, actually, you know, feeling the action and feeling the impact of the action, I feel like there is new filmmakers coming onto the scene who are like, no, we don't want to do like all CGI. We want to feel things. And I think like possibly that started way back with something like The Raid. I know that's like 10 years old now, but then I think it's continued, and I think it's got bigger with things like John Wick. And I think nobody is connected to the John Wick universe. And like, I feel like there is this kind of stream of action movies coming now that's kind of returning to like, like returning to the 90s, or, you know, or even before, and just making it more impactful and being like, yeah, well, like, CGI is cool and all, but like, we want to actually feel things.
Yeah. Well, this is also that period where you still could get away with like that really nice, I mean, what they call the middle budget area, right? Where it's not, you know, $200 million, or it's not under $10 million. It's like you can make a very decent movie for like, you know, whatever it may be, but that.
You imagine seeing a movie greenlit now for adults that cost $35 million.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, like, that is a thing. Like, yes, I mean, this, the mid-level, it's the bottom fell out of that market, you know, some years ago now. And yeah, like a movie like this being made for $36 million, you know, like now it just seems crazy. But I suppose we should actually, get into the movie, you know. Like, before we talk around the movie and
begin with a roadmap.
Yeah.
It does literally begin with a roadmap. intercut, like, it's like the credits are like on a roadmap, like, and then it's intercutting between that and just a Jeep driving. We don't know who's in the Jeep yet. It's going to be Kurt Russell, we know, but like, you know, we just see the Jeep, and we kind of keep cutting back and forth. And also, right, one thing I did want to note at the start of this movie, we're not going on another tangent. I'm actually talking about the movie now, is one of the things that struck me about the film, looking at the credit, was the music for this film, which I like, is done by Basil Poledaris. And Basil Poledaris, as many of you know who are listening, he's probably most famous for his score for Conan and for his collaborations with Paul Verhoeven, like Starship Troopers, Robocop, that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's just a weird score for Basil Poledaris. He's usually known for these big bombastic Wagnerian, you know, like all percussive crashing things. And this is, it's very different. It's all kind of harsh string. I mean, it's still quite harsh, but you know, like, it's not the bombastic thickness he's known for.
I found myself like a few times thinking like that it reminded me of the Terminator 2 score at times, and then like a little bit of Zimmer And at times, yeah. I'm just like, oh, this is a cool little space that this score exists in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Apparently, he made like two scores for the movie. The first score was rejected, and then like he made this whole second score.
The first one was just a piano the entire
time. I mean, I don't know. Like, maybe the first score was like a typical Basil Poledri score. Maybe the original score was like Conan, you know?
It's still one of my favorite things that, it might have been like Deathly Hallows Part 1, but like the color palette that the director used was vetoed by the studio. And I'd never heard of a studio being like, no, it can't look like that. Like, what was that color palette? I'm like, I gotta know. Yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay. So, Craig, tell us how the action kicks off.
Okay. So we have the couple, which, spoiler alert, Kurt Russell is driving, and they are doing their going across the country. We don't really know why at the time, but she's asleep. Well, Amy, she's asleep. And then Jeff is Kurt Russell, and he's the one driving. And he's looking for coffee at one point. His cup is out. So then he sees that there's the big kind of canister in the back. He goes to reach for it. And then this kind of rusted truck pulls out on this little stretch of highway, which, you know, causes him to then quickly veer to the left, and they honk at each other. And then she instantly wakes up, and he explains that this guy just pulled out of nowhere. But, you know, he admits that I did take my eyes off the road for just a second, but man, he just came out of nowhere. And then she talks about wanting to stop soon, and because they just need a break, and he's obviously tired. And you get the sense that, I don't know, that so they're kind of this middle class couple that are changing job, or they've changed jobs and they're going somewhere, but you don't, just like a lot of this movie, you're given enough information to really get you invested and keep you moving forward, but not to really bog down the story with exposition or any kind of character background besides that.
It's like one of my favorite things that, you know, when they stop and get snacks and she gets the donut thing, and it's like, you know, if you win this, you get $90,000 or 90,000 donuts. And they talk for a little bit about, you know, very briefly, but just like, wow, $90,000, that sure would solve some problems. And it's like, I mean, it's 1997, it's the dollars. Yeah. So like 90,000 is, you know, a pretty good chunk of change, but at the same time, like, it isn't really life-changing money. You know, so like just that idea of, you know, yeah, like we're not told what he does or why they're moving or any of that stuff, but it's like there's, and you know, it kind of speaks to judging a book by its cover, where, you know, these people sorry, I'm just going to jump ahead. You know, these people see a shiny red car in Massachusetts plates and are just like, our jackpot has come in, and like meanwhile they're in there just like, boy, these donuts could really turn things around for us.
yeah, for sure. And it's interesting what you say about like just giving enough little details of the story, because like apparently, according to the IMDb trivia, you know, sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. So we'll go with it. The film originally had a prologue which showed Kurt Russell's character, Jeff, as a cameraman in a war zone, and he witnesses the death of a young girl, and this causes him to like quit the job, or like, and this is what prompts the cross-country journey to start a new job. But the director, Jonathan Mostow, didn't like the opening and asked Paramount to test screen one version, the version we got, or the version with the prologue, and the test screenings came back that audiences prefer the version that we got.
And I agree. I think if you had that prologue, I don't know, I think it would change the whole dynamic of the story.
It makes it feel like a novel.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you said that, and I was like, oh my God, if this were a novel, that would be a fascinating subplot of like what he's going through. But it is not a novel. It is a 90-minute movie.
And also, it's kind of weird, like, because, like, you know, obviously there's a lot not said, so you're just kind of given little bits and pieces. And like, this character in my head does not work as a war photographer. He's like in insurance or something.
Yeah, I agree. The only part that, and obviously spoiler, and it'll pop up later, the only part that felt odd for me was when he's trying to call his friend on the cell phone and say, I know you have that buddy at the FBI, and that's really all where it goes. And that's kind of one of the standout points that I was like, oh, okay, I guess that makes sense based on what you just said, Scott. But besides that, no, I agree that it would be like insurance or something else.
Yeah. So like before the kind of that little discussion about the $90,000 and 90,000 donuts, they are like hassled at the stop station, like at the petrol stop, that by a character called Errol, who's played by MC Gainey, who funnily enough also played a character called Errol in Con Air, which came out in the same year.
And MC Gainey looks like Lemmy from Motorhead.
He does a bit.
Yeah.
Whose real name was Errol.
Yeah, there we go. It all ties together.
This is Cool Runnings Corner. There aren't any connections, but
it that whole exchange too is interesting because it kind of plays off in a way that, you know, where you have something like Deliverance where, you know, obviously the locals are clearly the bad guys, but you go in, and of course rewatching it, you're like, well, you know, Burt Reynolds was really cocky about it, or he kind of treated these people like lower class citizens or whatever it may be, where you're kind of watching this exchange. And Kurt Russell, again, we've talked about this in prior episodes, he doesn't really play the macho hero that we're used to with all these other kind of action stars, where he's just kind of this guy that's like, hey man, I'm sorry I didn't see you. And he's trying to just stop the situation from happening while, you know, Earl is trying to be macho and get and make fun of him and like call him a shithead and whatever else.
Craig, I appreciate you setting me up.
Okay.
This is the thing I love absolutely the most about Kurt Russell is especially in the context of like 90s action. So many of the 90s action stars were just like pure masculinity. So even, you know, you could put so many of the others into this movie. You could put Bruce Willis in, and Bruce Willis would be the put upon everyman, but then like just clicks into the gear of like, you know, you're gonna tell me where she is, and we're gonna, you know, I don't know. I can't do a Bruce Willis impression, but, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is just gonna like walk through every wall, or, you know, I mean, just,
I don't think
them.
You could put Arnold Schwarzenegger in this role. I see where you're going with this.
Oh, they would try.
I definitely see where you're going with this. Because like there's other 90s actors, like you could definitely have put like Bruce Willis or Mel Gibson in this role.
Yeah.
And they definitely towards the end, it definitely would have played out different. They would have like just puffed up their chest and like, you know, suddenly they were just beating everybody down. I do think it would play slightly different, but I see what you're talking about.
Yeah. Kurt Russell has that sense of humor that made him so perfect for John Carpenter, but like in this, especially I appreciated like his kind of bemusement. It's a very low key, but like, he has this sense of about him of just like, why are any of you doing any of this?
Yeah.
You know, like he's not looking for a fight which like you put Bruce Willis in this role and he, you know, he'll look like he's looking for a fight. But Kurt Russell is just trying to get where he's going.
Yeah.
Like, why do you have to pull out in front of me? Why do you have to, like, you know, why is any of this happening?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, this is what Kurt Russell gives you that nobody else really does.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Like, the only thing that because he's not antagonistic, I think the others would have been even the kind of ones that you could place as an underdog character, which I think, like, you know, Willis or Mel Gibson, you know, before we all knew what Mel Gibson was like, you know, at the time, would have been, like, the other ones that you probably could have put in this role. But again, I think they would have been more antagonistic. The only thing you could say about Kurt Russell's character is he's like a typical well-meaning, if slightly patronizing liberal, you know, cause he's like, you know, when he's like, oh, you know, like, when the guy's like going on about how nice his truck is and he's kind of like, yeah, but I suppose that's the kind of truck you need to get around here. And it's just like, I see that you're trying to be well-meaning, but it definitely could come off as patronizing that.
Yeah. To your point of like, he's not antagonistic. That is a perfect thing. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, but like, I love the moment when he goes back to those diner, and the guy's like, it ain't none of my business, mister, but if I was you, I'd check the ladies' room. And he, like, goes in and sees the thing. You know, like, if it, he just comes back out and, like, realizes, like, oh, I'm in your room. Like, he doesn't push anything.
Yeah.
Because he's just trying to, like, get his wife, like, figure out what's happening with his wife and get back out on the road. Whereas, like, if it were Bruce Willis, he would sidle up to the bar and, like, let me buy you a drink and then pour it on the guy.
Yeah. Or even with the bartender, like, you know, pulling the gun, or again, we're jumping mm-hmm. ahead, but he would kind of either hassle the bartender or pull him over the kind of bar and threaten him, and then, you know, the bartender would basically go weak at the knees, where in this part, the bartender has complete control. Like, you know, he pulls the gun, and then, you know, Kurt Russell basically, like, starts panicking and backs away and then sprints out of the door.
I apologize if this is a tangent, but, like, it feels relevant. But this kind of reminds me, especially that scene when the gun is pulled that we haven't gotten to yet in the recap.
We've not gotten to anything. We've not even got to the title breakdown.
Yes, we have. That happens before anything. But yeah, like.
Because, like, after we've just left the petrol station. We just left the gas station. So
the breakdown has not happened yet. We even see Kurt Russell. Anyway.
Go ahead, Adam.
We just watched this morning. Come on. I remember interviewing Ashley Edward Miller and Zach Stentz years ago, and they were talking about working on Andromeda. And they had written this script where Kevin Sorbo's character loses a fight, and they were, like, really proud. They're like, "Oh, it's gonna be cool!" Like, and Kevin Sorbo gets the script and comes back with, like, "I have a note. I don't lose this fight." And they're like, "Oh God, Mr. Vain, Hollywood star is like, I can't lose a fight. I'm a man." And they, in talking to him about what the scene was, they realized, oh no, he's right. Like, we had our idea, and we were servicing the idea and not the character and not the emotion and not the story. And so they changed, and he wins the fight. Like, I can see so many other people, like, the gun gets pulled. Kurt Russell is so good at being in over his head and recognizing that he is. And, like, so many other people would just be like, no, I'm not in over my head. You know, this may be their bar, but, like, I'm still me. And Kurt Russell is just like, nope, I did not expect a gun. I will be leaving now. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Anyway, what happens next, Scott? Yeah.
Well, after the 90,000 donuts conversation, the car breaks down, like the title of the movie, Breakdown.
Oh, that's what you meant, the titular breakdown. Okay.
Yes! Sorry for the confusion.
Sorry. Sometimes I'm dumb.
That's okay.
Good thing I'm pretty.
You are a very pretty man, Adam. Yeah. And then after that, we get some banter between Jeff and Amy, a bit more banter as just by the car, as they try and figure out what to do. And then it gets a bit tense as Errol drives by real fast, and then kind of in the distance kind of turns around and is kind of just kind of staring them down from far away, and they're getting a bit tense, and they're kind of like, what the fuck's going to happen? And they're confused, as, again, you know, as we were mentioning, Kurt Russell, whole lot of this film is like, why are they doing this? Yeah. So, like, they're both kind of like, why are they doing this? But then a big 18-wheeler drives by, and they're like, oh, okay, we'll flag this down. And Errol drives away. And then this is when we get the introduction of J.T. Walsh's character, Red. And he says that the engine, it looks like the engine has overheated, and, you know, like, Jeff is like, okay, oh, the engine's overheated, well, we'll just wait for it to cool down, we'll start up again. And then, but Amy's not kind of having that. She's kind of like, oh, you're really going to, we're just going to sit here for hours, you know, and wait, you know, like, I'd rather, like, hitch the lift and, you know, phone the repair guy, you know, phone, like, kind of, AA, you know, whatever. So she goes in the lorry with Red as you know, to phone the repair people and get them to come to the car, and that is the last we see of Amy for quite a while.
Yeah.
And Kurt works out what is after some more kind of inspection. He works out, he sees a wire loose under the car and works out that that is what has been causing the issue, and sets off to try and find Amy, who is apparently at Bell's Diner, which we've talked a little bit about already from a much later scene in the movie, which we'll kind of talk about again in an abbreviated form. But this is the first scene at Bell's Diner. And Adam, do you want to take it to Bell's Diner?
Kurt Russell's been told that that they're going to Bell's Diner. She told him she's going to get some iced tea and wait for him. And she is not there drinking iced tea when he walks in. And he thinks maybe there's a different Bell's Diner. He's very confused. But something occurred to me. Because the Jeep Grand Cherokee is a perfect choice of vehicle for these characters. In 1997, just a perfect choice.
Yeah.
Do you think they struggled at all to get Jeep, where it's like, wait, our vehicle breaks down and then his life falls apart? Like, we'd rather not have that, even though obviously later on it's shown. Like, I was thinking about product clearance and just like, huh, I wonder.
kind of spoilers for later, but maybe because it's like they didn't break down because of their mechanics.
Right. Yeah. It is revealed later on, but I was just like, because, they're reading the script and it's just like, hey, wait a second. I'm not sure how we feel about this. Kurt Russell walks into a diner and it is just like such a divey little place full of people who eat there every day of their lives. And, as we come to find out, there are machinations happening of which he is unaware. That I kind of wish I want a movie. Like, part of me is just like, there's so many movies like this. Like, can we do one that's about the town and how they put together these traps? Cause I feel I would kind of dig that.
I agree with you in that sense that, I don't know, there's this part, maybe because I came from a very rural, northern Midwest town that's basically either a truck stop or just for tourists, most of the year. And there's this part of me that'll watch some of these movies occasionally. Like, I'd just really like to see a movie where, like you were saying, where it's about that, or either where they're not kind of the horrible hillbillies or the rednecks or whatever it may be, where they're like the decent, it's just you have these kind of these town folk and you get to really live in it and see that world.
Yeah. When you were saying they're not the evil ones, I was just thinking of Tucker and Dale versus evil.
Yeah.
this is the second one, but I really do love the guy that says it ain't none of my business, mister, but if I was you, I'd check the ladies' room. Because it's just one line.
Yeah.
But the idea that he's having fun with what's going on, that it's a game to them, is fascinating to me.
Because to them, it's just like, oh, this woman probably ran off on her husband or whatever it may be. They don't know the severity of what happened.
It's funny.
Because the movie gives away so little, you don't actually know.
Oh, yeah.
The bartender, it seems, isn't in the conspiracy, but how many people in the town are in the conspiracy? We just aren't given the information.
And what if this conspiracy is what if this is one of those towns where it's like, oh man, ever since the highway, we don't really get anything. What if this conspiracy saved the town? What if the first time they did the trap was it literally made them $100,000 and they picked the right car and it saved them? What if this trap is why they have a school?
Yeah.
I mean,
who knows? Also, the other interesting thing I should have mentioned, just in connection to the season as a whole, is the bartender is played by Jack McGee. Yep. And just like JT Walsh, both were in Backdraft as well.
Yeah. Jack McGee's awesome. It's also just fun to watch his movies. Oh, that guy. Bruce McGill is kind of my favorite one of those. Bruce McGill walks into a movie and is like, oh, good. I don't know what's about to happen, but it's definitely not going to be boring.
Kind of going back about the whole town, because then you start even getting where you don't – it does it in such a way where you don't know who – is or is on in on this, as we talked about, but even where we're told that the police are in on it, but
but then something happens later on to suggest otherwise. And even with somebody like the bank teller, or that happens later on, it's just, I think, yeah, it's very effective in the way that how it handles it.
Yeah.
I just realized that I did not actually do what you threw to me, Scott, which is to say what happened. Kurt Russell figures out his car. He gets to Bell's Diner. He walks in. He's like, hey, I don't see my wife. Have any of you seen my wife? And they're like, nope. And he's like, well, that's weird. All right, I'm going to keep going. But if you see her, let her know, just like, stay here and I'll be back. And that begins the confusion. There you go, Scott.
Yes, that is exactly what happens. And then we go back on the road, where Kurt Russell, as Jeff, what was called Jeff from now on, he sees the lorry again, and he's like, I'm pretty sure that's the same lorry. And it just so happens that it is the same lorry. So he goes chasing after that. He sees Red, in his lorry, tries to flag him down, tries to say, like, you know, pull over, man. He's not having any of it. And then he nearly runs straight into a Winnebago, which Red helpfully points out to him in a very smug way. And then he, after saving himself and veering out of the way of the Winnebago, he then gets back on the road, and then he cuts in front of the lorry and does make it pull over. And then him and Red have a conversation. Red says he doesn't even know who he is. He's never met him in his life before. You know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Who's this wife you're talking about? Da 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 da. And then due to convenient plot mechanics, a cop rolls by. And again, as you mentioned, Craig, we don't at this point know whether the police are in on it or not. It just seems like it could be that the sheriff is just kind of a little bit incompetent, or it could be that he is in on the conspiracy. And again, talking about connections to other episodes we've done, the sheriff is played by Rex Lynn, who we last saw in our cliffhanger episode.
Yes. Well, and this actually voices what Adam's been talking about, where Jeff really says, like, why are you doing this? When Red keeps going, hey, I don't know you, buddy. Like, I don't know your wife. You must have got a wrong truck. And he's not being angry about it in the sense of, as again, like we'd see with normal action stars or anything. It's just like this desperation of like, what's going on? Why are you doing this to me? And to set in motion this whole thing.
You know what movie this, I was kind of surprised, but like this movie reminded me of Fargo a little bit.
Oh, okay.
And one of the great things, one of the many great things about Fargo is the Mike scene. And, you know, when Marge is just like going around talking to folks and then like talks to Mike and feels really bad and then talks to the lady and it's like, oh, right. People lie.
Yeah.
I forgot.
Yeah.
I'm going to go talk to William H. Macy again because he might be lying. And Breakdown had this you really get the sense that Kurt Russell like wants there to be an answer. Yeah. he wants there to be a reason that's not just like, oh, money or, you know, maliciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. oh, you're lying. Right.
Yeah, because he doesn't even try, like, his big major aggression isn't, like, even trying to hit Red or anything like that. It's that he, like, frantically sprints for the cabin, the truck's cabin, opens it up and starts, like, looking in to try and see any remnants of his wife. That's really all he does. And he doesn't, like, hold on to Red as Red's getting in the truck to leave. Like, he just stands there in shock, basically. Of like,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, he's a really good suburban dude.
Yeah.
He just, like, all of his reactions, like, for the first really, like, half plus of the movie are just like, well, none of this is supposed to be happening. Yeah. What the hell?
Yeah, for sure. Fargo is not one of the movies I thought about while watching this movie. There's a bunch of movies I thought about while watching this film. Like, this section of the movie most reminds me of the Vanishing. Just that sense of kind of just despair and just kind of like not knowing what's going on and trying to figure out the mystery of it. It like it stops being the vanishing about just over half an hour in, but like at this point, that's the movie it most reminded me of.
Well, Scott, you should know by now that I'm always thinking of Fargo.
Yeah, all right. fair point.
It is a movie worth thinking about all the time.
Oh no, Fargo is definitely is one of the Coen's best. Yeah, for sure. So where are we at? Oh yeah, right. So Rex Lynn's sheriff Boyd, he recommends that he goes back into, he doesn't offer to take him into, but like he's off somewhere else. So Sheriff Boyd's got shit to do. So he says, go and file a report, with my deputy. And again, we are still playing this game of, is this police department A, in on the conspiracy, or B, are they just incompetent? Because they've got like a million missing persons posters in this small shitty town. And it's like, geez, this police department does not know what it's doing.
Well, I will say, I'll tell you after the fact of my story about driving through the desert that makes it more obvious that it was freaky. But yeah, just looking and I won't burden anybody with that story. So for the movie itself, he just kind of gives it and then goes back to the diner, or gives all the information. And even the guy says, I'll let you know. And that's about it. Then when he goes back to the diner, and that's when you expect maybe more coming from it of being angry or that bravado. But then, and we've kind of already talked about this with the go and check the ladies, women's room, go.
Yeah, he's like starting to figure out, he's not starting to figure out that something's wrong, but he's starting to get out of his bubble, the inclination to check the checks, to check the order bills, that shows that he's starting to doubt things around
him,
which is what happens in the next scene.
And also, that is when it won't happen in the next scene. Absolutely. I don't think we've mentioned yet either, talking about Kurt Russell's performance and him not being antagonistic. The other thing that I think works in the film's favor is, now this movie came out a year after Escape from L.A., and in Escape from L.A., he is definitely, he's lean and muscular and very much an action hero shape. But in this movie, he's not. He's not. It's not like he's out of shape or anything. But certainly compared to his Escape from L.A. Physique, he's a bit pudgier. Just looks like a kind of middle class dad. That's what he looks like.
Well, even, the next film after this is Soldier, where he is ripped.
He worked out for 18 months after this film, so, that's
what... But, in this, earlier when we were talking about him being, a war zone driver, I was thinking about, when you mentioned insurance, it was I could see him being, a substitute teacher.
Yeah.
If you just took him in the wardrobe that he is in and put him in a substitute teacher movie... It would be, that guy's a substitute teacher. Totally believe that.
In all those substitute teacher movies. All I can think about now is the Tom Berenger film, The Substitute. That's it.
Damn it, Scott. Now that's what I'm thinking about. Anyway, what happens next in Breakdown so I can stop thinking about Tom Berenger?
Moving on from Tom Berenger. Again,
no Tom Berenger season.
Again, if you're really calling out for the substitute episode, again, you might have to wait for a while. Breakdown. What's happening in Breakdown? This is where we first meet Billy, who presents himself as the kind of somewhat slow kind of town idiot.
Or the simple-minded person device. Yes.
He gives out some information, kind of rather skittishly. He kind of tells, "Oh, you're the guy looking for his wife," and then kind of gives out what we believe to be kind of part of the conspiracy. And he seems to kind of throw out there that you're being dumb and you go to the police because the police are part of it, kind of thing.
Again, Like, and sorry to give away the ending, but like, in the creation of this trap, when did they decide that Billy needed to play a character?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I am so fascinated by how this whole thing, because it is remarkably well formed.
Yes, it is very, I mean, like, it is basically crafted like a movie. It is very much, you know, like, everybody plays their part and, like, you antagonize him here, you give him a bit of information here, you know, like.
Just enough to keep him going. You know? They even know. I mean, they have 3X structured their traps so well.
But they even have multiple plans because the initial was like, oh, hopefully they just both get in the truck at the same time.
Right.
Then that would be, you know, it solves it all. But if they don't, we'll just lay out the script for you. Here you go.
Yeah. yeah. So, they obviously, have like a plan B and C and, you know, like, everybody's playing their part. But we head back out on the road. Jeff is pretty desperate at this stage, and this is the part where it stops being The Vanisher.
Yes.
So it becomes more of an action movie from this point on. So there is a car chase with Errol. Basically, Jeff comes to like a closed road. He has that conversation that you mentioned, Craig, about his friend of a friend who's in the FBI, and then cuts into a car chase. And this happens 34 minutes in, and this is kind of the point where it kind of becomes an action movie. And, you know, we've kind of talked about, you know, CGI versus practical, and the practical stunts in this movie are really good. I mean, obviously, we have covered the movie with the greatest car chase of all time, Ronin, so it's not quite as good as that, but it's still pretty damn good. It's nice car chase. Jeff nearly runs into a digger, gets out of the way of that, and then makes a somewhat bold decision to start driving downhill into a river.
And I'll say it actually, I don't know, there's that, so when watching movies like this, there's that moment where I know it's become this recurring thing across Guilty Pleasures or this, where it's like, because the script says so, is kind of like the, if you had made shirts, that's what one of the quotes would be. But with this one, it feels, especially with his character, where he's just been had a gun point at him, and not just like a pistol. Well, he had a pistol, and then Earl points like an M16 or whatever at him.
Yeah.
And like, it feels, I guess, authentic in the way of like just not knowing what to do and frazzled, and okay, well, I'm just going to drive off this hill into the water or do something because I can't just stay here. So, I mean, it feels like it works. It doesn't feel like just, it's just because the script told us to do this.
I totally kind of expect, I kind of thought that the car might like make it through the water and get to their side. Yeah. It's just like, see how badass a Jeep is? I was still in product placement.
You're still thinking about the product placement?
Yeah. They used it for the Jeep commercials after.
I'm always thinking about how these people get money.
But that is not what happens. No.
Oh.
It just gets stuck in the middle of the river and Jeff tries to get out his window, but is shot at by Errol, and then so dives back into the water and gets out the passenger window, and then he is just, and this is the brief section of the movie, where it's like the river runs wild, and he's just riding the rapids down the river while Errol shoots at him.
Yeah. Which is a lot. I mean, I've never been shot at while doing it, but riding the rapids without a boat is a really fun thing to do. I don't know if either of you have ever been whitewater rafting, but it's awesome.
No, I've not actually done it. So maybe I have to try it.
Yeah.
Be one of your New Zealand adventures.
There we go.
Yeah, it could be.
Well, and then another person shows up too, which I know him from the masterpiece known as Cabin Boy, but I can't remember his name right now, but we know another another member pops up, and he says he drove off the or Earl tells him that he drove off the hill, and he pulls up in a larger truck.
Yeah, because he pulls the Jeep out of the water.
Yeah.
His name is Rich Brinkley.
Yes.
And his character name is Al.
There we go.
Although I don't think he's ever referred to as Al. I like, in my notes, I put him down as Greybeard.
Yeah. Welcome to the movie, Al.
Like, yes. So in this gang, in Red's gang, there's like 4 members, and Al is just like, Yeah. He's just there. He has like a funny line later on in the movie, but for the most part, he's just kind of set decoration.
He's just a pretty face. He's just there. He's just there for window dressing.
Yeah.
I love, so we kind of talked about Billy playing a character. So Jeff is hiding in the bushes, looking at Errol and Al putting his Jeep in the back of Al's lorry, and then he gets knocked out by Billy with the like butt of a gun. And then it is revealed when like, you know, Jeff's like crammed into a boot, and then it's revealed that he is for Americans a trunk. That's what I should say. our audience is like fairly equal, UK and American, so I don't know whether to trunk, boot, you know, whatever you want to call it, just doesn't matter, I suppose. And then we find out that Billy has been playing a character. He just played the character in one scene, like it just seems so wrong.
And how he's no longer the character as he rips his hat off and shows his long hair.
Yes. His flowing blonde locks, where he's just a cool, pretty boy.
Yeah.
there is this is a tangent. This is 1000% tangent.
Okay.
But there is this woman. I live in Queens, and I live right off the 7 train. And we have a lot of people on the subway here because, you know, America is not doing great. There's a lot of people panhandling, and there's all different kinds. Some people put on a show. Some people, try to, sell you candy. Some people just ask for money. This woman gets on the train, and she is crying, and she's holding a picture, and she talks about how her sister died that morning, and she's trying to raise money for the funeral. I've seen her do this 6 times. And at some point, I remember thinking, how did you decide, like, are you like a frustrated actor? Like, how did you decide you wanted to play a character in your panhandling? You know, like, what part of you is this serving? I've told my friends, I'm like, I wish there was a way to say like, hi, I just want to buy you a coffee and ask some questions. Is there a way to do that respectfully? So Billy having this character to play, like, made me think of that, of like, was he like the kid in high school in our town or whatever? Like, did he want to be an actor? And like, this is how he gets to like do a little bit of acting. Like, what part of Billy led to the creation of, well, gee, mister, they don't tell me nothing about that. Like, where did that come from? I am so fascinated again by this whole thing.
Yeah. I do wonder if it'd been like, you know, Red is like outlining the plan and how, you know, they're going to capture these couples, and they're going to kidnap them. They're going to take their money. They're going to kill them and the whole setup. And then, you know, like, you're going to all antagonize them at this point, and then I'm going to act all friendly and kind of scoop them up. And, you know, Billy came to them and been like, yeah, but I don't want to be one of the antagonists. Like, if one of them gets away, what I want to do is, like, fool them by making the other person think that I'm on their side. And I'm going to do this through, you know, being like a kind of friendly simpleton. And Red's kind of like, sure, Billy, you know, whatever you want to do. I'm like, yeah,
right. He's the young one. He's probably like, you know, he's the one that can like run people down or whatever. Like, he's like the most able-bodied of them all. Like, but it does occur to me that you're going to be talking to Mostow in a few days, and you could just ask him these questions.
Yeah, that is a
very... Wait a second, we can actually get answers.
Yes,
that's great.
Do you know what? You know, I'm going to let you in on something here about my thoughts before this episode. So I was thinking about this film, and I thought, you know what? Where I'm going to make this episode with Adam and Craig, and in tribute to this film, I'm going to try and make it as taut as this film, you know? And I was clearly deluded.
That's adorable.
We just can't help ourselves. Tangents galore. It's what we're like.
Oh, I'm sure Adam will be concise this time.
Yeah, yeah. I can't bring it all to your door, Adam. You know, we're all equally to blame. Yeah. I think we've all already had a tangent each, or more than a tangent each.
I know. I really want to hear Craig's story about driving through the desert.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. When do you want to present your story about going through the desert? Is that for later?
I mean, I can do it now. It fits.
We're now firmly in tangent corner, so yeah, why the hell not,
Craig? Let's do it. So when I was moving, my partner and I were moving back from Los Angeles after spending about 5 years there. We were driving back across going through California into Arizona and New Mexico area, but we were driving across the desert and we left late. So it was the middle of the night and there's this stretch in the desert, which if anybody has driven it, where it's like 200 miles of nothing basically. And in the middle, there's you're told there's one gas station or so, right off the highway. And so we're driving it. We're like, well, I mean, we have enough gas. It's either we just make the whole drive and we're running on fumes, or we can just stop at this gas station. But it's going to be about 2 a.m. So we go and we stop there, and my wife obviously doesn't want to. We go off and it's Route 66, which is the whole area is completely dead. Like there's no lights on. There's nothing. The gas station is even closed down. There's a light over the pump, and like 200 feet away, there's semi trucks with their lights on facing us, but there's nobody in the cabin that I can see. And so I pull over, I stop, and I'm like, it's going to be fine. It's fine. Like I'm going to get out. I'm going to get gas and then we're going to go. And so I'm pumping gas. And then as I'm pumping, I start hearing, and again, I'm not seeing anything. It's completely silent. I start hearing this sound that can only come from a human. It is going, ooh, ooh. And it sounds like it's right on me, but there's nobody there. I'm like, oh, what the heck? And I finally pump, I quickly, get in, and I'm like shaking. I'm trying to be like, it's fine, nothing happened. We're just going. So we're going on Route 66 to get back on the highway. And like a mile down is this other gas station that was the one that was talked about, where there's tons of people, completely lit up, everything. It's great. So after the fact, my wife, who her family is social workers, they're like world renowned, all that, and they have a lot of social worker friends. She's kind of telling this silly story and saying, like, here's this kind of creepy thing that Craig had to deal with. And her parents' friends were saying, well, oh, I know that, actually. I know that stretch because I used to work in sex trafficking. And so what was happening was it was a stop where in this desert, somebody was trying to signal to me that, like, are you dropping off somebody for human trafficking? Because if I knew the sign, then, I'd go over to the trucks or whatever they were to then drop off my wife to, for human trafficking.
Holy shit.
So that is, my desert story. And, and it's right off this desert in this area where, if something were to happen, you could go in any direction and nobody would ever find you.
It's funny, when I was moving to LA, I drove from Cincinnati to Los Angeles, and it occurred to me while I was driving that, like, boy, it would be easy to disappear in America.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Ugh. Well, that's a creepy story.
That is my story.
So it feels kind of weird going back into the movie after that terrifying tale, but that is our job, so we will do that. So I did want to make a point about the movie. There is something, I love how well crafted this film is. So we have the conversation right at the start about the $90,000 or 90,000 donuts with the packet of cheap gas station donuts. And then when Jeff is in the water riding the rapids, once he gets to dry land, he sees that packet of donuts again. And we it's kind of played as this kind of little emotional beat of like, oh, I remember that conversation, and Jeff remembers that conversation. You can kind of see it in Kurt Russell's face. And it's kind of like, and you think, oh, it's just done for that, to kind of, to feel the emotion of where Jeff's at. However, when he is kidnapped and he's stuffed into the trunk, and we open up the trunk and he's being interrogated by Billy and Errol. He is like, they are quizzing him about a specific amount of money. His wife has said that he can get them a specific amount of money, and they want to double check what is that specific amount of money, because mm-hmm. they want to know if they've been bullshitted by her. And he's kind of scrabbling. He's kind of like, oh, I don't know. Like, I can't say exactly. And then, you know, Billy is getting annoyed. He says, like, he's basically saying, like, yeah, like a rich guy like you doesn't know exactly how much money you have. And Earl says, yeah, this guy ain't no donut king, which again, the penny drops for him and he says $90,000. And I just love the setup of that, of just being like this innocuous thing. And you're just like, oh, well done movie.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's such a wonderful little touch. I concur, Scott.
Yes.
Point well made.
Excellent. I'm glad that came across well. so then we get like a properly disturbing scene where Red is, you know, comes back into the movie. And at this point, he has dropped all pretenses of like, oh, I don't know who you are. You know, like he is full on villainy now. And, you know, previously when we've come across JT Walsh in the season, which we have a couple of times because he appears in both Backdraft and Executive Decision in both movies playing a shitty politician.
But not Cool Runnings, goddammit.
That's true. But in this movie he's like full on villainy, and he's quite a scary villain in this movie. Yeah. And I think one of the scariest things is the scene that's happening right now, where he just simply, in a very, very matter-of-fact way, does a description of Amy. But it just feels so icky.
Yeah.
Yes. You're so right. No. Sorry. This is Lupe, who we're now going to hear because the dog has finished her bone. And she wants to cry a bit.
Yeah.
Lupe, what are we doing? You just want another? Yeah, it's a very disgusting description.
Well, and it plays into, I don't know, this whole moment too, because Jeff keeps saying, you know, I want to see my wife, or I want, you know, kind of evidence that my wife is still alive. And it makes it clear that he is not the one in control at all, because they never let him know. And then he still keeps doing what they're asking, because it's like he doesn't have any other choice, which again kind of would deter from, I think, how this would have been handled with another action star or even another version of this movie.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. As we've kind of discussed a few junctures in this episode already, they're definitely, with nearly any other action star at this point in the movie, even if the character did eventually acquiesce to what Red was demands, there definitely would have been some sort of shoving match, or he would have punched out either Billy or Earl and then been convinced and strong-armed into it. But he just realized he has no cards to play, and he's just like, okay, I'm just desperate to get my wife back. I'll do anything, whatever you want.
And that thing is to go into the bank, which is, it's probably about some 100 yards away, into this town that is basically just surrounded by desert. And they know one officer, there's two officers in the town. One is in the foothills, so will not be back for a long time. And they called a fake accident, which would take the other officer 20 minutes to get out, 10 to realize there isn't an accident, and 20 to get back, whatever. So he has 50 minutes to go to the bank and transfer all $90,000 into, you know, cash to then bring back. And they're going to be watching him is all that they say. But, you know, while he's doing this, you don't necessarily know if they are watching him or if other people of the town are involved, as we've already discussed, or if it's just kind of like the scare tactic. But either way, it works. So when he's in there, he doesn't know who is in on it and who isn't.
Which he plays beautifully.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, because the scene that happens next in the bank is, it's absolutely beautifully played. in terms of he thinks he can trust the bank manager. He seems like probably not in on it. So he tries to attempt to like tell the bank manager, you know, what the situation is. But then this other guy starts talking to the bank manager and he looks like a bit sketchy, a bit of a redneck, but looks kind of like he might be part of the gang. So he just immediately shuts down and he's just like, no, just give me the money. Like I had a bit of a car accident or I don't know where my head's at. And you know, just, I just need the money.
Yeah. And credit where credit's due, both the bank manager and the sketchy guy also play it perfectly.
Yes.
Oh yeah. 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 The way the sketchy guy like just sits down and is kind of just perusing through the magazine, but you know, like in a really kind of, sketchy, kind of nasty
and, like,
way.
But it's also totally possible that he's just like there to like get a loan and he's like, when is this guy going to leave so I can talk to the manager about getting a loan? Why does he keep looking at me?
Yeah, that is what worked because in you know Jeff's mind, it's all sketchy. But then you kind of if you take a step back, you're like, no, all these people are just being normal. It's just he's viewing it that way, and he does that whole thing of where he goes into the bathroom, and again another kind of action moment where he's like trying to find a weapon to potentially use, and there's nothing, or he finds like the plunger handle that he's going to use and it's, no, that's a bad idea. And he just like stop and he doesn't do any of it until, you know, he ends up grabbing the letter opener.
I like that the bank scene of Breakdown is our Rashomon where it's like, oh, we can break this down from all these different angles.
Yeah.
yeah, for sure. For sure. One of the kind of, you know, like, you know how you mentioned, you know, the scenes in movies, you know, because the script says so. And again, it totally works because, like, you know, the plot won't go forward without it. But there's, like, the little wraps for the money to show what the denomination is. It just happens to be on the bank manager's desk, just kind of lying out so you can just grab them.
Which is totally plausible.
Yeah, no, it's fine. You know, like, it's not like a big kind of like, oh, that just seems totally implausible. It's not. It's just like one of those kind of things. Of, oh,
it's
right.
A crazy day to bring my battle axe collection to work.
Yeah, no. Yeah, he goes into the loo and finds a minigun or something. You know, it's not like that. dear. He goes into the parking lot and finds the battle van from Tango and Cash. That's
there you go.
I was just out in Virginia a few weeks ago and like there's a ton of Civil War shit there. And like now I'm just thinking like, oh yeah, the cannon outside the town bank, he just like turns around. Like that's the Liam Neeson version of this movie.
Oh yes. Which is, I mean, as we've discussed a bunch of times so far, like that's kind of a cool thing about the character Jeff. You know, he's not a man with a particular set of skills. He's just a man who's just like desperate and you know, doing what he has to. And you know, he kind of has some action skills later on in the movie, but like again, he's just really bumbling around getting by.
This movie reminded me, especially at this part. The whole sequence when he's like walking down the street and then, but I don't know if you guys remember a movie called Nick of Time.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I was thinking about how much better this version is and how much better Kurt Russell would have been in that character.
Yeah.
Because he has that particular set of skills as an actor that like Johnny Depp just like never quite felt like that person.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I know what you mean.
Right,
like, I don't know. Like, he doesn't work as well in that kind of role. Like, there's certain roles that Johnny Depp always excels in, but it's not necessarily one of them. No. Like, I suppose, like, partly because Johnny, there's a slight kind of otherworldliness to Johnny Depp. There's like it's not like he can't really do every man. Like, it's not
right,
really
exactly
in his wheelhouse.
He's like a little too pretty to be an everyman.
Yes.
Like Kurt Russell's a very attractive man, but he's like you could see him as a neighbor. Yeah. Like if Johnny Depp is your neighbor, you're Elon Musk.
Yeah, fair point. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's something just a little bit too cool, a little bit too rock and roll about Johnny Depp for him just to be like normal suburban dad. Whereas like Kurt Russell, as much as he is a good looking guy and he does look like a Hollywood star, he's grounded enough that he can still pull that off.
Yeah.
Dog's freaking out. Sorry.
That's all right. It's okay.
I know you don't have to go for a walk because I just took you out.
And talking about, like, excellent segueing, talking about going for a walk, Jeff is instructed to go for a walk and then get into the first pickup truck that he sees.
Yeah, which is Earl. And again, it goes, as we've kind of talked about before, where he wants evidence that his wife is still alive. And Earl's like, you give me the bag of cash, I'm just going to shoot you dead right here. And so he just, you know, gives the bag of cash and then he gets, his hands, bound by the duct tape and yeah, and it's then put in the truck with him.
As Earl, right, I gotta figure out what this is. I'll be right back, guys.
Okay. So Earl duct tapes, binds his hands in duct tape and then sits them in there. And as they're basically driving with the money, which Earl believes is the $90,000, and Earl is just kind
of. I will be back as soon as I can, but she very clearly wants to go outside, so I'm very sorry.
No problem.
Okay.
Okay. This is the first time this has happened in the recording.
Okay.
But like, it's all okay. Good.
Here, I can finish the, I guess, my thought process, and then we'll.
Yeah. Yes. We will continue on. This is podcasting gold. I think.
Okay. So yeah, Earl the whole time is basically just mocking him and talking about, you were such an idiot with you were so easy with your fancy, you know, your fancy car, and you just came up and like, you just went through with it. So yeah, he's just mocking him. And during this time, Jeff even gets hit to the side and he's trying to basically cut himself free with the letter opener that he grabbed at the bank. And Earl is just, yeah, mocking him and talking about the whole thing. But then at that moment, Earl finally starts looking at the cash and we see that what Jeff did was put, the hundreds on the end and then filled, you know, these stacks with ones. And so, you know, because I think he was only able to get 5,000.
Yeah, it was 5,000. He tried to get an extra 6,000 on his credit card, but he couldn't do that. So it was 5 grand he got in the end.
Which again, then kind of goes where you learn about, it gives us just enough where you learn about their money issue, that there's something with kind of money issue, but not fully that, you know, they obviously have nowhere near $90,000 to spend.
Yeah, for sure. But then I suppose like, yeah, this is where it becomes even more of an action movie because like he does become a little bit more of an action hero from this point of the movie.
Yeah. But I mean, fortunately, I think it doesn't feel like he goes from 1 to 100, which I think helps. Like it does feel like it's just that frantic nature of that he gets himself free and he stabs Earl but it's not like he's doing, you know, full on, I guess, fist fighting, and it's very messy in terms of the fighting. You know,
that is true.
Yeah.
It's not like he's suddenly becomes an elite commando or anything with, you know, like special fighting skills. He is just again scrabbling around trying to do his best. This is quite a kind of fun action sequence because he stabs Earl in the shoulder with the letter opener and then he pistol whips the fuck out of him. He like smashes that gun into his face like at least half a dozen times.
Yeah. And I mean, I like the part. So he binds Earl's hands and then he binds his neck to the backrest of the seat. And so his form of like torture is either pistol whipping him in the face, asking him what's happening or where's my wife at, or he's slamming on the brakes, which is then choking Earl.
Yeah, he becomes a bit Jack Bauer at this stage.
Yeah.
pretty much just for this scene, he becomes Jack Bauer.
Yeah, because after the Boyd shows up, and they're pulled over because the truck is swerving and slamming on its brakes and everything, he kind of goes back to that normal nature, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, the kind of the character that we have learned about up until this point, and has been following up until this point. Yeah, he goes back to that character, but yeah, just for this kind of one scene, Jack Bauer.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned, yes, Sheriff Boyd does turn up, and he demands that Jeff comes out the car, and Jeff is trying to explain. He's like, I've got the guys, you know, you didn't believe me, but I've got the guys. I was right. It's, I'm not going mad. It was the right lorry. These people have got my wife, you know, just listen to me. And Sheriff Boyd's like, ah, none of that.
You have a gun in your hand right now.
Yeah. And to be fair to the film, again, you know, it all kind of reads. It's not like, you know, sometimes in these movies, you know, whether it is one of the, you know, this quite often happens in action thrillers, or like also in horror movies and kind of stalker thrillers, where it's like self-evident to anybody with a brain that something dodgy is going on, apart from to the police force. They're like, nah, it seems all good to us. Whereas this is like, it does seem like a dodgy situation, and like, you know, I'm sure you wouldn't know what to think of being like, is this guy just crazy?
Yeah, we see this truck swerve all over the place, and then he walks out with a gun. I mean,
I am back. It does
make, okay.
Good to have you back, Adam.
Thanks.
Just to catch up, we're just after what we've now dubbed as the Jack Bauer sequence, where Jeff tortures Errol for a little bit before just becoming Jeff again. And now he is being held up by the sheriff while Errol frees himself from being duct taped in the car.
And we were kind of saying how to Boyd, it makes sense that because here he sees this truck swerving all over the place, then this guy jumping out with a gun. Like, it doesn't seem like he's just completely clueless that it, you know, why it makes sense why he would tell Jeff to get on the ground.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, like, cause there's also kind of a, like, isn't there a beat where they see each other and like recognize or?
Yeah.
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 What doesn't make quite as much sense is, so Errol now knows the situation and can play up to the fact that he has been pistol whipped to death and also tortured in the car, and can, you know, kind of plead the innocent and be like, oh, this guy, he came and tortured me, I don't know why. But instead, he's like, fuck this conspiracy, I've had enough of all this play acting, I'm just going to shoot the cop.
Yeah, well, I think because there's the cash in the car. So, I mean, there is more evidence that for, I guess, Jeff's benefit than, I guess, you know, the original run-in with Red where there's nothing at all.
Well, I mean, like, but again, that's easy. Like, you could just say this guy is crazy. This guy's crazy. He held up the bank. Then he pulled me over with a gun and is, you know, like, it, I mean, they've been play acting well so far. Like, I don't understand why they just give up on it, because it's like, now we're an action movie, so we don't care.
Yeah, I mean, because the only Billy is the one that is made to seem like he's the more frantic, or, you know, just wants to get this money and wants to do this later on, because you hear Red yell at him about, like, he needs to calm down or something.
Yeah.
Where Earl seems like he's, you know, he's been through it enough where he'd know how to play this game that they're doing.
But anyway, that's not what happens. He shoots Sheriff Boyd in the neck.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then he's, you know, he goes after Jeff, and he is about to shoot Jeff. But wouldn't you know it, Sheriff Boyd isn't quite dead yet and shoots Errol in the head, and Errol is dead. And that's it. That's the end of Errol.
Yeah, and you have this moment where it kind of, where Boyd is trying to call for assistance because he's been shot now and he really can't. And where there is this beat with Jeff where it's like he doesn't know whether or not to actually help Boyd, but it doesn't feel like he's being a dick about it or any sense.
Right.
Like, he just doesn't know what to do. Yeah.
This guy needs help and they're like, who are you?
Yeah.
He's like, I'm the guy that has to go to a truck stop, sorry.
Yeah.
Just call an ambulance. Then.
Just call an ambulance. Where are you? I don't know. It's a dirt road.
I think Sheriff Boyd, he tries to say something on the radio. So I think they know his position from what his original communication was.
Yeah. My only thing I'll say is he leaves Boyd in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't try and pull up to the side or anything.
That's a fair point. Yeah. I think that is kind of one of the moments in the movie where it's just like, you know what, like, we got plot to get on with, you know, like, this character is a side character. We don't really care. It's fine. Like, this is Jeff's story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we truck along to the truck stop. And what happens at the truck stop, Adam?
What doesn't happen at the truck stop?
What happens? Yeah.
Every cop has converged on it, and he being Jeff, sees a few people who look like J.T. Walsh. They're wearing the trucker uniform of a blue trucker hat and denim, everything. And then he finally finds J.T. Walsh on a payphone telling someone that he is that there's just too much heat at the truck stop and he's out of there and that they should all meet at the farm or the barn. I don't care if you have to drive all night. Get her to the barn. I'll see you there. And Kurt Russell makes sure that he has his gun. And I kind of thought, like, oh, maybe, you know, but he just, like, watches JT Walsh get to his truck and then chases it down on foot. I love that scene. I mean,
it's so good.
I don't think I'm brushing past anything significant.
No, you're not.
Him, like, I love the stagecoach scene of just like, now I got to get on this truck. And he grabs the undercarriage and he's like pulling, you know, kind of climbing up that. And like a family station wagon drives by and a kid sees him and does not react whatsoever. And yeah, it's such a cool, like, there's so many little beats in this movie where you feel like John Mostow, like, must have, you know, sat in traffic and just, like, looked at a semi-truck and, you know, had that moment of just, like, how would I climb this? Like, what, you know, like, because as a kid, I would watch these things and it's like, I don't want to climb a semi-truck. I never did. But, yeah, like, it's such a fun and, like, really well-done, like, tense, you know, even though it's Kurt Russell and you know, like, it's not gonna go badly for him, but he finds all these little places of like, okay, you know, like his foot slips here and he's grabbing for this and there's the mirrors and he's gotta make sure he's not seen. And just all, like, it's such a perfect little bit of like stakes filmmaking. You know, you understand every single beat of it and just how hard it is for him to do this. But it is also not quite superhuman, you know? Like, it's not, like, it's believable that a person could do this, kind of. Yeah.
It's believable within a context of a movie. Like, it's not kind of like, oh, this is ridiculous.
Like, getting out of an airplane in Commando where you're just like, none of that would happen.
Yeah, that's true. It's like ridiculous. It's like ridiculous, but in a grounded way. It's
A grounded ridiculousness. That's a good term. I like that. It's totally a movie thing, but this movie really never puts a foot off a path of like believability.
Yeah.
I also like, again, you know, it's much like the donuts thing. I like the kind of little moments where it kind of points things out to the audience, where there's, when he is kind of climbing across the undercarriage of the trailer of the lorry, there is a shot, there's like a close-up of the gun in his back pocket, and you kind of know that it's going to fall out his back pocket. And then, like, you know, 2 seconds after that, it does. And there's just like these moments that kind of like really highlight things. And you're like, oh, all right, I know what's going to happen. And I like stuff like that in movies.
Yeah, it's kind of like Die Hard in that way, of just like Die Hard seeded all these little things so that like when this guy is going through this adventure, like this is why he doesn't have this, but this is why he does have that. Like, okay, now he doesn't have the gun, so he can't attack J.T. Walsh, but maybe he wasn't even planning. Maybe he was just going to ride, but like then he'd have a gun, so they'd be on equal footing, but then he loses that. And like it is all kind of conspiring to like make Kurt Russell have to be just like sneaky, sneaky the entire time. You know, he is always at a disadvantage until he is not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even when he is not, he still is at a disadvantage.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though the one moment, which will be coming up shortly, where he kind of has everybody at his, or well, we'll get to it, but is holding everybody up, like he still ends up being at a disadvantage at one, you know, one point during it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, like it does, it's interesting as well, kind of connecting the Kurt Russell-ness of it all, you know, like the character of Snake Plissken inspired the character of Solid Snake in the Metal Gear Solid games. Mm-hmm. And as we go into the next scene, it kind of, it does become like a kind of Metal Gear Solid kind of mission, like in terms of like the way he climbed onto the lorry, and then also in terms of the way when the lorry stops, he then climbs onto the roof of the barn and has to sneak about the kind of rooftop of the barn.
Yeah, which it actually has, I don't know, this is one of those moments again when watching Tombstone versus this, which we're going to get to when he's sitting there and he's looking over them, and this barn is filled with obviously tourists or, you know, all the people that have driven and have been captured by this group before, all of their stuff is in there. You have, you know, stacks of cameras and whatever it may be. And he's watching it. They pull in, and when they pull out his wife, finally, after all this time, and they think she's dead because, you know, she's wrapped in that like blanket or in that bag. And I think that's probably like one of the moments where I was like, oh, this is like Kurt Russell really. Like, this is a great acting moment for him where you just, where he's like so quiet and isn't fighting or anything. He's just watching it and you see the tears well up because he thinks his wife is dead. And
I'm not like I'm not a big video game person, but it's a thing I always love about, or a thing I love about Last of Us is that part of the gameplay is you have the option to just hide and sneak around. Yeah. You don't have to like go charging in. And he you know, once he gets to, you know, once he gets on the truck and the truck gets to where it's going and they're at the farm, like, it is then a masterclass in, like, not being seen, and he has to, like, find a spot, and, like, and he's trying to get to, like, high ground. And then, it leads to them thinking that she's dead, and, like, he can't say anything, and because he's still not somebody who's going to, like, go charging into a room, but, like, it's all his eyes and his face. And it, literally in one shot, it's just his eyes.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's really just tremendous work.
It's a great moment. It's a real kind of like, and it's a real suspenseful moment. Cause you think for a second, like, oh, is she legit dead? Like, is that, you know, is it just going to be like the final act's just going to be like a revenge thing? Or, you know, or
well, what? Because we've been thinking about The Vanishing, we're kind of primed to think that she's dead.
Yeah.
You know? This kind of goes back to the Black Widow thing earlier of like the clarity and the simplicity of the filmmaking. Like, Mostow just, he seemed to know exactly what he wanted to do with this movie. You know, like, and I'm sure that there were like discoveries and accidents and little miracles, but like, you know, because every movie has those. But you really, like, that's the thing that I really thought about this morning watching it is like, man, this is a sure-footed film.
It is. It's very taut. It's very economically told. Everything's very streamlined, very tight. you know, for sure. And so, I'm, yeah, okay. who wants to continue with the plot? Shall I continue with the plot?
I guess. So after that, they shut everything down. She's confirmed alive, but she's basically put into the cellar under the floor and then put into what we're told is a freezer, but he doesn't actually ever see it. The guys all get out, they leave, lock the place up to then go have dinner with,
breakfast. It's 6 a.m.
Or breakfast. Yeah, breakfast. Sorry. Breakfast with Red's son and his wife. And so, which she is, there's this tiny moment where he gives his son, like a Swiss Army knife, and his wife, it's like, oh, I didn't expect you home so soon.
For a week.
And,
yeah, you're supposed to be back next week.
Yeah.
And so then we get kind of where Jeff is going in through this house, but, and he has
Can I butt in for a second?
Go for
because
it.
Like I legit laughed at this moment in the movie because of how annoyed Red's wife is that everyone ignored her call for breakfast at least twice before they came. She
She doesn't know they're putting a body in a freezer. I also really like that it's like, oh, you're supposed to be back for a week. His truck is empty. He is, you know, like when you're watching, you're thinking like, oh, I guess he's finished that. You know, he has unloaded the thing and now he's like heading back, you know, but like the idea that he was supposed to be out for a week, it's like, how, what? how does your long haul work? It's like, or are you even working? Like, is this a front? Are you like driving a truck for anybody or is this just your truck? And
That could be it. I mean, he could just, it could be an entire front. He could just be telling his wife he's a trucker and like all he's doing is picking up tourists and kidnapping and stealing their money and killing them.
Yeah. Cause like, as we soon, as we're about to see, like she doesn't know nothing. Like she has some awareness, which I do think is like, it kind of goes back to the Jeff and Amy thing of like, you believe this relationship. You believe they've been together for a long time. And, you know, so she may not know there's a freezer in the bottom of the barn and that she may not even know about the false floor, but like she definitely knows that like some stuff is happening because as we're about to see, she has zero problem making a very difficult demand of somebody. Yeah.
That is a fair point.
What is that difficult demand, Scott?
Well, that difficult demand is like basically Jeff is doing his Solid Snake impersonation and is sneaking about the house. He's got a gun. He's found another gun in the truck when he was in the barn and he's sneaking about the house. He is looking in the different rooms to see where everybody is. He sees the son is playing Doom. I don't know if that's deliberate product placement or not. We'll move on. And then he hears everybody in the other room having breakfast. And then he bursts in and he holds up the gang. So like sitting there is Red and Billy and Al and Red's wife, and he holds him up and he demands to, for the, because he was trying to, you know, he was trying to get his wife free, in the barn, but he couldn't get the cellar door opened, because it was locked and there was no way to break the lock. So that's why he had to go in the house and he's demanding the key and then he is held up himself, by Red's young son, Deke, who has Red's rifle. And like you say, it's kind of a weird character moment because Red's wife seems perfectly normal when we are first introduced to her and seems kind of like whimpering and bemused in a minute when we go to the barn. But in this one scene, she's cold-blooded as fuck and he's just like, shoot him!
Yeah. Yeah, there's no, like, bring me the gun or anything like that. It's just like, nope, you shoot him. Yeah. So if you don't shoot this stranger, you're grounded, young man.
Which Jeff is even, like, your mom isn't good. He keeps saying it, like, your mom isn't going to be hurt. You're not going to be hurt. This isn't about her. Like, he's trying to talk through with this kid. in a very sensible way.
Well, because he, and this is why, like, I don't remember if I said it when we were recording or not, but, like, I started thinking about what, like, a Straw Dogs with Kurt Russell starring would be, because he is clinging to, I am a good person, I don't do this. Like, and he never overtly says it. You know, he never says, like, oh, I would never. And, I mean, he has, obviously, caused the death of, but like, he still can't bring himself. Like, I, you know, I really never felt like he was actually going to pull the trigger.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I do feel that watching this movie, that your friend Jonathan Mostow probably does have a less nihilistic worldview than Sam Peckinpah, which is not a high bar to clear, but it's just.
I like that. I think you're absolutely correct. Although maybe now, you know, you spend 1997. Yeah, you spend 25 years in the movie industry. You know, maybe that's what did it to Peckinpah. Maybe Breakdown 2 is nihilistic as shit. Yeah.
Well, you never know. You never know.
Yeah. Tell me my movie reminds you of The Vanishing. I'll show you The Vanishing.
Yeah. It's like the ending of The Vanishing is dark. Whoa, you've not seen nothing yet.
Yeah.
Oh, dear, dear, dear.
Yeah. And then, but like, also, that kid, like the kid, I mean, the kid and Red's wife, like, both are very believable. That kid, you know, just has like a moment, but he is very believably, you know, confused as to what to do.
I absolutely agree with that, because the kid is like, you know, kind of puffed out his chest and wants to be the savior of the day and wants to stick up for his dad, and then just before he pulls the trigger, he has that moment of like, and he starts crying because he, you know, it obviously dawns on him what he's about to do, or what he might be about to do is kill a man. And then like, obviously you see the consequences of that in his face. And in that moment of indecision, that's when, like Jeff kind of hits the gun kind of away from him, right. So it ends up like shooting off into Al's shoulder, which doesn't affect Al all that much. Al's surprisingly mobile and later drives a car without too much effort, which is quite funny.
Do you think the kid was like expecting one of his parents to take the gun, so like
he can menace, but
wasn't expecting them both to be like, yeah, now shoot him. Yeah. Pull that trigger. He's just like, I really thought I had done the first part of this.
Yeah.
I feel like I've done my bit. Like, you know, I've held the guy up.
Yeah. And also the house. Like, before we get out of the house, which is about to happen, I thought the house was incredibly well-dressed. Like,
yes.
Because it is a creepy house, but also just like, as someone who has spent plenty of time in impoverished, you know, post-industrial America, like, yeah, that's just a house. That's like, they have, you know, you have a room where just like a bunch of shit is, you know, and the, you know, I think like there's the dining room that has a bunch of stuff piled, and like there's this, I won't speak for anybody else, but like I had a moment of just like, it almost feels like part of the trap that like they've lured him in. Because you start looking in the rooms, so you're like, what the hell? And then you hear them like talking and laughing. But I thought the house was really well executed.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that as well. And it does, again, it builds up suspense well. And again, you do kind of feel like, oh, are they still watching? Are they just luring him in? Is this part of the kind of trap that they've made? You know, but it turns out, no, it's like they didn't realize he'd managed to sneak in. But after we do get out of the house, and Jeff does manage to set Amy free. He like marches everybody out, takes them all to the barn, and then he manages to get, I don't know, like it seems like overkill that they put Amy in a lock cellar.
And
in a locked freezer within a locked cellar. It's just like, Well, I mean, that just seems slightly excessive, but sure, anyway, they do that. And then basically one of my, this might be my favorite, no, it might, it's very close, but one of my favorite moments in the movie happens here where basically they're all being marched into the cellar. And Red turns around and he starts as if he's going to do like a kind of Hannibal style monologue, and Kurt Russell is just like, fuck you, and puts him in the face, and I was legit out laughing at that.
Yeah. Yes. No one takes a boot to the face like JT Walsh.
Yeah. It's so good. He gets like 9 words into this monologue that he's obviously prepared. Yeah. And
you better
he's
remember
just like,
this.
No, I'm not having this. Fuck off.
Yeah. Oh, and we should say too that Billy, during the whole, once the shoot, the gun goes off, Billy escapes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
He just takes off running. Yes. Like a bat out of hell. Yes. Yeah.
Kurt Russell, or well, Jeff, he slams the door, locks it, even throws, it's like a heavy tool cabinet or tool shelving thing on there. And then they start looking for keys to any car, which is nice because it fits more too with, because in movies so many times it's like, oh, they just open up the, what is it, the visor and then the keys fall out. And that's not the case. There are no keys for any of these cars to be found.
Do you know what? And it's just hitting me now, but like, you know what movie would make an interesting double feature with this? Is The Way of the Gun. I don't know how well you guys remember that movie.
That's the one, it's got Ryan Phillippe in it, right?
Yeah. It's Chris McQuarrie's first film as a director.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It is nothing but ideas. Like, it is, Chris McQuarrie has watched so many of these movies. And so every scene is like a riff on a trope. So there's, you know, low speed, you know, chases. There's how like military action would work with something. There's the, I mean, just, and this movie, like, John has so clearly watched so many of these movies, and it really is just like, well, what about that? Like, why are the keys always there? You know, who leaves their keys in their car? Wouldn't you take them inside? So they are just like, okay, we have to go inside and find the keys. Like, there's so many little kind of grace notes within it.
Yeah.
And I would, like, Way of the Gun, I do adore, but it is so inaccessible to most people because it is just the ideas. And whereas this one is like, you know who's really good at acting, right? Kurt Russell. Let's just put the camera on Kurt Russell and see what happens.
Yeah, that's true. Because, I mean, you do watch this movie and you do kind of feel like this film is like if you stuck Deliverance, The Hitcher, Duel, and The Vanishing in a blender and added Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
It's this film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, I'm sorry, it's just going to be an but like, I was thinking about like where this came out, 1997, you know, we were still kind of in the post Tarantino, post Pulp Fiction, you know, like, you know, where, you know, 2 Days in the Valley was happening and like people were making these like clever capital C riffs, on the crime movie and on this and on that. And like this, you know, this never calls attention to the fact that it's engaging with the genre, with the tropes, because it doesn't have the self-aware dialogue that like was what everyone thought this, you know, like after Pulp Fiction, it's like, oh, we have to like comment on what we're doing while we're commenting. Let's get metatextual, kids. Yeah. Like this is just like, no, I've seen a lot of movies and I have some thoughts and I don't care if you don't catch them all.
Yeah. It's interesting because this movie is 24 years old, but it feels older. I think even for the time, it feels like a kind of throwback thriller to something that would have been made in the 70s or early 80s kind of thing.
But I would like what you were saying, Adam, what's so nice about this and what we saw after Tarantino and I mean, what we kind of see now with a lot of the throwback stuff is that like this still very clearly stands on its own. There's so many now that it's like without the references, you're just kind of watching, you know, don't you remember this movie? That was a good movie. And then you go, well, then I'd rather just watch that movie that I really liked instead of this one.
When this thought was occurring to me earlier, I thought like, oh yeah, this came out the same year as Scream. Like, of course it did.
Yeah.
like, yeah, that's where we were in 1997.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I thought Scream came out. I think Scream came out in 96. I think Scream 2 might have come. I think Scream 2 came out in 97.
Oh, maybe you're right. Because it was Christmas 96.
Yes. I just looked it up. 96 was Scream.
Okay. But Scream 2 and I Know What You Did Last Summer came out in 97.
Yeah, that's when horror went the full meta route after that for a bit. Yep.
Things got very meta for a while there. But anyway, that's a whole different topic for a whole different podcast, possibly over on my horror show. But this is all about action and we got some action to talk about because this is where the movie is like, yeah, you know, like it was fun being a top thriller, but now we really want to be an action movie. So we're just going to throw some action at you. And during their search, for the keys, they're searching through a stationary caravan and Red has been set free by Billy from the cellar and he's back in his lorry and he just drives right through the middle of the stationary caravan and boy, is it fun.
I when we were talking earlier about like Jeff almost running into the Winnebago, I thought, is this Chekhov's RV?
Yes. Ah, dear. This is kind of weird because, like, again, there was another episode where Chekhov came up a lot, like, in executive decision. I can't remember. There was Chekhov's flying lesson and Chekhov's straw in that movie. It's weird. It's weird that Chekhov has come up so much this season.
I mean, when you create such a strong dramatic principle,
that is true.
You're gonna
recur. Yeah. That's a fair point. So yes, Chekhov's Winnebago.
Yeah. but the semi truck bashes through, but they have found the keys, and it's time to skedaddle.
And he even tries to call. Again, he has the worst luck with calling people because he finally gets somebody on the line. He's like, just trace this call. I don't know where I'm at. And then the truck smashes through and you're like, oh, the phone's destroyed now. They can't even do it.
The mind boggles to think what happens when Jeff Taylor orders a pizza.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But miraculously, they so happen to get into the right side of the Winnebago and survive and then run to, they've now got the keys and they run to the car that they've got the keys for. And then we are off on a car chase. It's a fun car chase.
And what's nice too is, the car chase, because this truck that they get into is kind of rusted and old. And so it doesn't fit the, you know, where they're all in fancy fast cars or whatever. It's like they're in this kind of thing that can't even get that fast. So it's not like they can really outrun anybody. And
that's true. I do like the kind of, like this gang are like so well organized in what they do. Everything they do is almost like as if we're watching a movie. Like everything they do is so well choreographed to the point of this in the car chase where they create a kind of pincer movement where Billy's car is on one side of the pickup that Amy and Jeff are in. Al, who is driving while shot in the shoulder, is on the other side and they're kind of compressing them together. And then suddenly Red is at their tail and it's all very well choreographed. That is until it all goes pear-shaped and Billy's car flips over and in classic action movie style explodes immediately.
Yeah. Not before he gets out a couple of shotgun blasts.
That is true. That is true. Yeah.
Bye, Billy.
Billy, yeah, we'll miss your acting, Billy.
We hardly knew you.
Apart from that one character that you created for reasons that only you know, and we really want to dig into further, yeah. But now anyway, you're dead. And then Al gets an entertaining death as well, because Red's 18-wheeler goes out of control. The trailer detaches from the cab, cutting right across the road, and Al drives right through the trailer.
Yeah. I mean, what works, I mean, this is, and again, like just with the action, the fighting sections, that it's messy and so it feels kind of real in that sense. Even with the shooting, it's not like Jeff has become a expert marksman. Billy isn't either. They just kind of are shooting around, barely getting anything. And then he even runs out of bullets at one, because he just can't hit the target. You know, in a different action movie, he would have shot one of them or hit the tires out of one of them or whatever it may be.
And this, yeah, that's true. It's all, yeah, like you say, what is over the top as this section of the movie becomes, like what we talked about, the kind of new term that we've just coined, grounded ridiculousness.
Yeah.
The action is haphazard enough that you're kind of like, go with it, even though you're kind of like, oh, this is ridiculous. This is clearly where we've become like a proper action movie.
Yeah, nobody's ever like, I've got one bullet and it's got to hit these three things. I've got to spin my eyes.
Yeah, everybody just spraying bullets everywhere. Nobody really knows what they're up to.
Yeah.
We're pretty much at the climax in the movie. Red is tracking them down. Okay, Craig, tell us what Red's up to now.
Okay, so Red has kind of been hitting into the back of Jeff and Amy, and until they go around onto this bridge, and yeah, their car is just not fast enough, and he starts smashing them onto the side, and it becomes kind of the slow, but it builds the tension that he just keeps like smashing into them more and more, and they're slowly going off the bridge. But then it just kind of jams.
Gentlemen, I believe that's a wrap on me. Okay. I don't know what's going on with it, but I will be back as soon as I can. But I know we're almost at the end, so I'm very sorry.
No,
that is okay. And,
it was really nice talking to you guys, and thanks for getting me to rewatch this movie. And we'll be chatting soon.
Excellent. See you. And that is how Adam exited this episode.
So he's slamming into them, and it's basically, instead of them being pushed off of the bridge, they're just getting wedged more and more into the metal railing. And Amy's leg ends up getting basically latched down into, where the underneath the dash or the, was it the glove compartment and in between the seat and with the railing and everything. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Jeff keeps trying to get out, but he doesn't want to leave his wife. But finally he gets out and he jumps. He's able to sneak around and jump into the truck with Red, and they fight, which then sends the truck off the bridge, but the truck kind of gets stuck on a railing and is hanging there while the two of them are then climbing up, and they have kind of the one action. I mean, even though, yeah, this has turned into this action movie, it's the one that I think fits the most into the trope where, they're hanging on this truck and then they're doing a fist fight kind of thing. But it's still, again, frantic, and it's still messy and not to the extent that you would see with Stallone and Cliffhanger or whatever.
Yeah, that is very true. I think that, so when they kind of tip over and the truck kind of tips over and then they're both kind of fighting on the truck, I think obviously that is kind of a classic action beat. Yes. Particularly, so like in this kind of sequence of the movie, we have the car exploding, which is very much a classic action beat and you would find in a million action movies. And I find that this is another point where you're like, oh, this is very much an action movie now, when he, and don't get me wrong, I still got a lot of enjoyment from this scene, but like when, you know, Red is like, throwing the chain about and then Jeff grabs the chain,
yeah,
and the camera gives a close up of Red where he's like, oh no, I'm fucked. And yeah, it gives a close up of, Jeff, like, ha ha, got you.
Yeah.
And then Jeff throws him off the cabin of the truck. That, I, you know, is very much like a kind of stereotypical,
yes,
action beat, but I still enjoyed the heck out of it because I think because the film does such a good job of making Red such a piece of shit. Just yeah, like it makes a really good job of Errol being such a piece of shit that you're just desperate to see them die.
Yeah. Well, and this is kind of the one moment too where you've seen Jeff, even when he takes things into his own hand, he's pretty, you know, he's not really in control as we've talked about. So this is the kind of our one moment where we've watched him, you know, this whole movie, and then finally he's in complete control and he's where it's like the, I guess the fist pump element of like, yes, finally he's got it. Like, he's finally, you know, ahead of these guys in one, in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. This is his one proper action movie swagger moment.
Yeah.
And like, Adam mentioned, Breakdown 2. You know, like what Breakdown 2 would look like, whether it would be much more nihilistic or whatever. But the thing I really like, and I know I saw some reviews that didn't like it so much, like the Roger Ebert review didn't seem to quite like the ending after it being such a kind of top thriller. But I do quite enjoy the ending, the fact that, so it's set up in this kind of horror movie way where Jeff and Amy are looking over the bridge at Red's dead body in the valley, you know, in the river, he's hit his head on a rock. And then he kind of twitches. And this is like, this is almost like setting up for like Breakdown 2, Red's revenge. But no, no, no. Amy lets the truck loose and the truck cabin drops onto Red. Yeah. And it's such a satisfying moment, and even though it's ridiculous and over the top and arguably doesn't fit the tenor of the movie, I still enjoyed the heck out of it.
No, I agree. I mean, there was, and I will say this, you were talking about horror movies, and it's funny because watching this, there were certain moments, because I guess, you know, this type of plot has been common in many horror films.
Sure.
But there was, like, watching the ending of, like, you know, in a horror movie, what would happen now is another person would come by and be like, oh, do you need some help? Or, you know, or something that would be like, uh-oh, it's going to set it up again.
Yeah, the nightmare continues kind of thing. Yeah, for sure. And, yeah, like, I mean, there is beats in this movie that, as much as it's an action movie, there is beats in this movie that kind of make it feel like a horror as well. It's a bit like, you know, when we're back in the barn, when Kurt Russell finds all those boxes with all the cameras and stuff, like, it really reminded me of the scene in Wrong Turn with the kind of car graveyard and stuff like that. You know, so there is, and obviously there's lots of, you know, redneck horror movies. So it made me think a lot of that kind of film.
Yeah. No, I agree completely. And, but I mean, this, we pretty much get them after that. Then they're just sitting on the bridge holding each other, and we're kind of, they're just basically there alone. We're assuming that the cops or somebody will hopefully come by at some point, but that's, yeah, basically it, that they're just holding.
Yeah, that's the end of the movie. And also, I kind of like that beat as well, because again, in a lot of action movies, just like in a lot of horror movies, you don't often see like it ending on the kind of trauma of the event.
Yeah.
Like, cause it almost reminded me of the ending of Last House on the Left.
Yeah.
Where the couple are just kind of hugging each other at the pool, and like, just what they've done has kind of dawned on them, and the trauma of that, and the grief, like in that movie, you know, they're also grieving for their daughter, and it's all that emotion is now been delayed, and it's all hit them at once, and their whole world has come down, and they've got is each other.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I know this is because I know you talked about this on your other podcast, New Horror Express, with Neil Marshall Stevens. I remember some advice that he gave and things they talked about with new horror movies or issues that he had was that these movies kind of always want to end now on a cliffhanger, on the jump, on the whatever. And there's so many movies that don't just want to let the movie end and let it kind of have that resolution. And there is kind of this, or he was talking about missing that. Of like, here's a fully formed film instead of, oh, here's something that is meant to be either a franchise or meant to continue, you know, be continued in a sequel or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
A fully formed thought, I guess, you know.
Yeah, that's true. And it's interesting, like, yeah, a lot of movies don't do that. And it's, you know, it's another kind of clever thing in this movie that it gives this kind of breath for the audience to kind of let what you've just seen sink in, you know. So they're cuddling each other in the bridge, and at that point there's no music, and then it cuts to credits, and for a few seconds, I didn't count it, I don't know, like maybe 20 seconds or whatever, again, as the credits start to roll, no music. It's just like totally muted. And then and then a gentle part of the score kind of cuts in, as some of the credits have already rolled. And it gives, you know, it lets the movie, it gives you this kind of moment to let the movie sink in. And I think it's really, again, that little silence is really well placed.
Yeah, I agree.
And, it's kind of strange. This episode's been kind of strange. I mean, apart from the dog interruptions and the kind of tangents, you know, it, we always have strangeness like that. But yeah, this episode's kind of strange because my kind of greatest criticism of this movie is that it's nothing more than a well done thriller. It doesn't stand out in the same way that The Vanishing does. Yeah. Or, it doesn't stand out. You know, in the way that a truly classic movie stands out, but it is an excellent example of what it is. But other than that, I can't really criticize it that much.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, again, I did watch it before, but I'm counting this as basically my first watch since I couldn't remember. And no, this is one that I think for the first time in this whole podcast that we've been doing this together, where it wasn't something that I watched as a child and then it's like, oh, now I'm picking it apart or whatever it may be. This was just like, I just enjoyed it from beginning to end. I didn't really have anything with it. And it was another one that was like, oh, I think maybe we'll buy the Blu-ray, or maybe I'll buy, like, I might watch this again. Like, this is, I like this.
Well, again, letting the audience in on all our secrets, this is being recorded in July, but when this episode comes out, and you know, you will be listening to this, if you're listening to on the day that it comes out, on the 29th of September. And if you are doing that, this new, brand spanking new special edition of Breakdown will have been released just the week before. So if you have this episode has interested you in the movie, pick up the special edition. It's got a new commentary. It's got new interviews with Kathleen Quinlan, who plays Amy, new interviews with Kurt Russell, a bunch of bonus features and all that stuff. We're not being paid for any of this, by the way. No. We just thought we'd flag it up to you.
Yes. Support physical media.
Support physical media. Yeah. Get special editions. You know, they got fun stuff on them. They got fun behind the scenes stuff. And yeah, that's it. I think we've said all we can say on Breakdown. Would you say, Craig?
I agree.
Okay. So it just leaves us to kind of wrap up. And Craig, do the normal social media details. Yes. Tell people everything.
If you want to follow me and see the stuff that, or follow me on Twitter or Instagram, it's either, on Twitter, it's Craig Dram, and on Instagram, it's Craig.Dram, D-R-A-H-E-I-M is where I'm primarily at. I also have a, you know, Facebook or whatever, but also I co-host Bloodhound Picks, where we look at kind of older, obscure and independent horror films and we highlight them. Or sometimes we also will do segments called Industry, where we'll talk to members of the horror community, from bloggers to filmmakers to scholars to whoever it may be, and talk about what it's like working and being a part of the horror industry in kind of this modern era. And so that's what we'll do. That is Bloodhound Picks, P-I-X. And yeah, that's on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and we have the website bloodhoundpicks.com as well. But yeah, that's where you can find me if you're interested.
Excellent. And you can find me on my other podcast at New Horror Express, either on the website newhorrorexpress.com or on Twitter and Facebook. The Twitter handle is at New Horror EXP. Or if you want to contact this show, you can always do that on our Twitter at 90s_all. Or you can even hit me up at ScottMurphy85 if you want to do that. Tell us your thoughts on this movie. Tell us your thoughts on any of the movies we have covered in this season. We would love your feedback. But that is all for this time. Please do join us next time in our season finale, when we will be covering Soldier. But until then, see ya.